Chapter 13. The Duel for Labor Control on Border and Frontier. How in North Carolina and Virginia, in the border states and on the southwestern frontier, the dominant white worker after the war sealed the fate of his black fellow laborer. North Carolina presents quite a different situation and method of reconstruction from the states studied. The war left the state in economic bankruptcy. The repudiation of the Confederate debt closed every bank, and farm property was reduced in value one-third. The male population was greatly reduced, and the masses were in distress. In 1800, North Carolina had 337,764 whites and 140,339 Negroes. In 1840, 484,870 whites and 268,549 Negroes. In 1860, there were 629,942 whites and 361,544 Negroes. There were 30,000 free Negroes in 1860, a class who had in the past received some consideration. Up until 1835, they had had the right to vote and had voted intelligently. In the 19th century, one of the best schools in the state for children of white aristocracy was conducted by John Chavis, a Negro, educated at Princeton. Many Negroes had come into the state during the war so that their proportion of the population increased in 1870 and 1880. In general, however, emancipation was not attended by any great disorders, and the general tide of domestic life flowed on. The Freedmen's Bureau issued rations to white people as well as colored, and many were kept from starvation. Large sums of money were received from the North in 1866, 1867, and grain and provisions as well. When President Johnson called North Carolina whites into consultation concerning his proposed plan of Reconstruction, many of them were highly indignant, some even leaving the room. They did not propose to share power, even with the president, but wanted to put their own legislature back in power. They finally acquiesced, and William W. Holden was appointed provisional governor May 29th. He ordered an election for a convention with a white electorate September 21st. By June 27th, 1,912 pardons had been granted in North Carolina, 510 of which came under the $20,000 exemption. Here, as in other states, there came the preliminary movement of planters to secure control of the Negro vote. Alfred M. Waddell, in July 1865, editor of the Herald before the war and a colonel in the Confederate Army, spoke to the colored people of Wilmington and denounced taxation without representation. He advocated the extension of the suffrage to qualified Negroes. The Sentinel said it was opposed to Negroes voting, but would open its pages for discussion. Favorable articles appeared by Victor C. Barringer and David L. Swaint. The idea was to forestall any attempt of Northern white leaders and capitalists to control the Negro vote. The Negroes, however, had thought and leadership, both from the free Negro class, who had some education, and from colored immigrants from the North, many of whom had been born in North Carolina but had escaped from slavery. During the year 1865, Negroes circulated petitions asking the president for equal rights. The convention of 1865 met October 2nd. The ordinance of secession was repudiated and slavery abolished, but no action at first was taken on the Confederate debt. Johnson interfered, and at last the debt was formally repudiated, although the leading papers of the state call the action humiliating. The General Assembly met in November when the 13th Amendment was ratified, but the vote explained that this amendment did not give Congress power to legislate on the civil and political status of the freedmen. A commission was appointed to report on new legislation for the freedmen. This commission reported in 1866, and the General Assembly passed a bill which defined Negroes and gave them the civil rights that free Negroes had had before the war. An apprenticeship law disposing of young Negroes, preferably to their former masters and mistresses, was passed, and Negroes could be witnesses only in cases in which Negroes were involved. In 1867, there were acts to prevent enticing servants, harboring them, breach of contract, and later seditious language and insurrection. The adjourned session of the convention in May made a significant change in the basis of representation. Formerly, 3/5 of the Negroes had been counted in the representation, but the new constitution changed the basis to the white population alone and allowed only white persons to vote or hold office. During the state convention, the Negroes had met in Raleigh and adopted a set of resolutions which asked in moderate and well-chosen language that the race might have protection and an opportunity for education. They also asked that discrimination before the law be abolished. They said nothing about the suffrage. In the fall election of 1866, Worth was chosen governor. He advocated the rejection of the 14th Amendment. The legislature agreed. Holden, the former provisional governor and now leader of the Republicans, changed his attitude toward Negro suffrage and in December 1866 openly advocated votes for Negroes. Holden says, "The people of North Carolina had rejected President Johnson's plan of Reconstruction on the white basis. They had also rejected the Howard Amendment, under which they could have returned to the Union as Tennessee did. Nearly 3 years from the close of hostilities had elapsed, and we were still under provisional forms with the national military paramount. What was to be done?" In a conversation which I had with Thaddeus Stevens in December 1866, he told me he thought it would be best for the South to remain 10 years longer under military rule, and that during this time we would have territorial governors and territorial legislatures, and the government at Washington would pay our general expenses as territories and educate our children, white and colored. I did not want that state of things in North Carolina. I did not want to run the risk of a practical confiscation of our property to pay the expenses which would have been entailed upon us by these military governments. I did not want North Carolina to cease to exist as a state. I confess, I feared confiscation of property to a greater or less extent, especially as President Johnson had said to me in May 1865, "I intend to confiscate the lands of these rich men whom I have excluded from pardon by my proclamation, and divide the proceeds thereof among the families of the Woolhat Boys, the Confederate soldiers whom these men forced into battle to protect their property in slaves." When the Reconstruction Act was under consideration in Congress, the North Carolina Negroes sent a delegation to Washington asking for the removal of Worth and that Holden be relieved of his disabilities so that he could again be put in office. In September 1867, after the Reconstruction Act had passed, the Negro leaders called another convention in Raleigh. Among these leaders was James H. Harris, born in North Carolina but educated in Ohio. Even the whites acknowledged that he had great ability. Another leader was James Walker Hood, born in Pennsylvania and sent south as a missionary by the African Zion Church. He became eventually a leading official in the organization of the public schools of North Carolina and finally was elected bishop of his church. Other Negro leaders were A. H. Galloway, Isham Sweat, and J. W. Ward. This Raleigh convention asked for full rights and full protection and the abolition of all discrimination before the law. They especially demanded ample means and opportunity for education. The convention resolved itself into an Equal Rights League and established a newspaper. The order for general registration was published in May 1867, and the registration was to begin in July in 170 registration districts. In the appointment of the boards, Governor Worth wanted to avoid the appointment of Negroes, but recommended a few. For the general board, G.W. Broody, a colored minister from the North, was selected by General Sickles. There were 106,721 whites who registered, and 72,932 Negroes. 93,006 voted for the Constitutional Convention, and 32,961, all of them white, voted against the Constitution. The Constitution was ratified April 21, 1868, by a vote of 93,084 against 74,015. In the registration, 19 counties had Negro majorities, and in several other counties, the white majority was less than 100. Immediately, there was an attempt to organize political parties. A People's Convention met March 27th with white and black delegates. It was denounced by the planters as a meeting of Holden's miscegenationists. The colored delegates took a prominent part and made many speeches, and a Republican Party was organized. On the other hand, an attempt was made in Raleigh to call a colored mass meeting, at which Governor Worth and other conservatives were to speak, the idea evidently being to divide the Negro vote between the parties, but the conservatives did not respond. Among the colored people, there was growing a strong feeling about the land. Some wanted the land confiscated and given to small farmers, but many of the northern capitalists opposed this. Harris advocated taxation of large estates so that the land could be sold and opportunity given Negroes to buy. On the other hand, he wanted the disabilities of the planters removed, while most of his followers were opposed to this. The election was held in November 1867 and resulted in a large majority for the convention, although over 50,000 people, mostly white, did not vote. On January 14, 1868, the Constitutional Convention on the Congressional Plan convened at Raleigh. Of the 133 members of the body, 18 were Northern carpetbaggers and 15 were Negroes. The leading carpetbaggers were H.L. Grant of Rhode Island and the Reverend S.S. Ashley of Massachusetts, afterwards the Superintendent of Public Instruction. The Reverend James Walker Hood of Pennsylvania was the outstanding Negro delegate. The Reverend Ashley was made chairman of the Committee of Education, and from this position he greatly influenced the educational provisions of the Constitution of 1868. The leading Negro members were James H. Harris, J.W. Ward, J.W. Hood, and A.H. Galloway. The next year, Hood was made an agent of the Bureau of Education, and there did his life work. In the convention, the chief matters of discussion were segregation in schools, intermarriage, and propositions concerning holding of state offices by Negroes. The records of the proceedings of the convention adhere strictly to parliamentary form. There were no speeches by any of the members of the convention recorded. The Constitution, which was adopted, had a Bill of Rights in which men were declared equal, slavery prohibited, and the people's right to education asserted. Property qualifications for office were abolished, and universal suffrage and a system of public schools ordered to be established. There were also provisions for vagrants, a penitentiary, public charities, and orphanages. The convention wrangled over the question of separate schools for Negroes and finally refused to make separation of races in schools compulsory. They discussed intermarriage and universal suffrage. There was a proposition to get loans from Congress for agricultural purposes and buying land and homes. This was declared to be pay for Negroes, for their long labor without reward, and for their services during the war. Loans from $3 million to $10 million were proposed. The convention passed 75 ordinances and 56 resolutions and sat for 55 days. The reception of this constitution and the work of the convention was characteristic. The planter press in the state was strong, and it insulted the convention in every way possible. The real brunt of the attack, however, fell not on the Negroes, but on the Northern capitalists and leaders. The Republican Standard called the convention one of the ablest, most dignified, and most patriotic bodies that ever assembled in the state. The reactionary Sentinel called it the so-called convention of Ethiopian minstrelsy. Ham, radicalism in its glory. Some said that the pillars of the Capitol should be hung in mourning for the murdered sovereignty of North Carolina. And Josiah Turner, who was the chief credit for finally overthrowing Reconstruction in North Carolina, said, "In the legislative halls, where once giants sat, are adventurers, mannequins, and gibbering Africans." The North Carolinian, February 11, 1868, said, "The Cowles Museum contains baboons, monkeys, mules, turgi, and other jackasses." Evidently, the state, by a combination of northern capitalists and Negroes, and by corresponding refusal of the whites to cooperate, was passing under a new regime. In the convention, the carpetbaggers had large influence in the committees, and when the state was organized, they undertook to run it upon a larger scale, spending more money, certainly, in part for the reason that the state had more things to do, as, for instance, public education, internal improvements, the extension of the credit of the state, and public improvements. By 1868, the ex-planters in North Carolina had begun to organize themselves as Democrats, although some of them, for financial reasons, became scalawags and allied themselves with the carpetbaggers. The conservatives fought the Constitution on the ground that it made the Negro a social equal, and while it gave representation to the Negro, it did not give representation to property. In Wilmington, for instance, it was said that Negroes cast the majority of votes, that 39/40 of the real estate belonged to the white people. Property was thus arrayed against labor, while labor was allied with the new carpetbag capital. The new capital was in the hands of persons who had but lately come to the state. In no state was the fight of planters against carpetbaggers more bitter. Due to the long presence of the army in the state during the war, with the easy communication by water, a large number of Northerners after the war chose North Carolina as a likely home and place for work and investment. Holden summoned the legislature to meet July 1, 1868. In his inaugural address, he defended the carpetbaggers and stated that in the history of the state, most of the leaders had come from the outside. This legislature ratified the 14th Amendment and voted down a provision for separate Negro schools. There were 3 Negro members of the Senate out of a total of 15, and 16 members of the House out of a total of 120. 2 of the Negroes acted as speakers at various times. Among both Negro and white members, there was considerable illiteracy, and among the local officials throughout the state, it was said that few of the Negro appointees were competent, and many of the white ones were not. Thus, the Reconstruction problem in North Carolina, while it had to deal with ignorance and inefficiency, was only to a very small extent a Negro problem. The real fight in North Carolina was between the old regime and the white carpetbaggers, with the poor whites as ultimate arbitrators, and Negro labor between, struggling for existence. The brunt of attack was the northern newcomers. The combination by which the white immigrants gained control of the state, with the support of the Negroes, had to meet, as in all southern states, a charge of extravagance, if not corruption. During the 2 years of the government of Holden, the debt of North Carolina was increased from $16 million to $32 million. It is doubtful, however, if Holden could be held responsible for this, and certainly the Negroes could not. Most of this debt was to aid railroads. The aid granted to railroads by the Convention of 1868 and the legislatures of 1868-1869 was generally approved and passed by votes of members of both parties. The object was to extend and complete the general railroad system, and the popular belief was that immigration and consequent development would justify the improvement and secure the state against loss. These expectations have been disappointed. Immigration was checked and prevented. Part of the bonds were sold as a sacrifice, and the proceeds misapplied by the officers of the companies. Among the men managing the railroads and converting the proceeds were members of both political parties. The planters who bore the taxation raged with cries of fraud and theft. The Sentinel said, "Rave on, ye radical plunderers, but your days of iniquity and fraud and corruption are fast coming to an end. The people, insulted and robbed, will not much longer suffer you to pursue your foul practices and elude public justice." The North Carolina, served, loved, and honored by Gaston, Hash, Badger, Swain, and Ruffin, is the same North Carolina no more. She is now the hog trough of the Union, where Littlefield, DeWeese, Laughlin, Tourjee, Heaton, Ashley, Brewer, and Abbott, and such swine come to wallow with native hogs like Holden, Victor, and Greasy Sam. Many things show that, in North Carolina, Land and Capital were bidding for the black and white labor vote. Capital, with universal suffrage, outbid the landed interests. The landholders had one recourse, and that was to draw the color line and convince the native-born white voter that his interests lay with the planter class and were opposed to those of the northern interloper and the Negro. The boycott on the part of the planters against Negro labor, unless it voted right, was severe. When the legislature of 1868 adjourned, 88 of the Republican members signed a bitter address to the people, which was militant labor striking back. Did it ever occur to you, ye gentlemen of property, education, and character, to you, ye men, and especially ye women, who never received anything from these colored people but services, kindness, and protection, did it never occur to you that these same people who are so very bad will not be willing to sleep in the cold when your houses are denied them merely because they will not vote as you do? That they may not be willing to starve while they are willing to work for bread? Did it never occur to you that revenge, which is sweet to you, may be sweet to them? Hear us, if nothing else you will hear. Did it never occur to you that if you kill their children with hunger, they will kill your children with fear? Did it never occur to you that if you good people maliciously determine that they shall have no shelter, they may determine that you shall have no shelter? And now, be it remembered that in the late election, there were more than 20,000 majority of the freemen of North Carolina who voted in opposition to the Democratic Party. Will it be safe for the landholders, householders, and meatholders to attempt to kick into disgrace and starve to death 20,000 majority of the freemen of this state? Again, later, as the power of the planters became stronger, the Standard, representing the carpetbaggers, said, "Can there be any remedy under the forms of law? We think so, unquestionably. Of course, it is not to be supposed that men and women and children will starve to death while corn is still standing in the fields and while hogs and cattle are not kept under lock and key. But these are matters of minor importance and are to be expected, however much the necessity may be deplored. What we mean is that there is one efficient remedy for this wholesale crusade of oppression carried on against the colored race to starve him into voting against his choice. The remedy is this. Whenever the Republicans have control of a country, let a meeting of the commissioners be called at once. Let them make out a list of all the colored stonemasons, bricklayers, plasterers, painters, and carpenters. Then let them select a site of sufficient dimensions for a village of from 5 to 1,500 colored paupers, as the case may be. The work itself will give employment to a considerable number of persons, and some time will be required to complete it. Then let the county paupers be moved in and be provided with houses and food at the expense of those who have made them paupers. The tax be so laid as to affect only the large landholders. Not 1 in 20 owns any land at all, and the large landholders are much rarer. This tax will fall lightly upon the great mass of people, while the oppressive landholder will be compelled to throw his broad acres upon the market to raise money to pay the taxes. And in addition to this, let the legislature deprive these exacting tyrants of the benefits of the stay law and compel them to pay their debts, to pass their lands under the sheriff's hammer, and give the poor a chance to buy land." Governor Holden was accused of being the head of the Union League, which was the organization of white and colored voters, of believing in social equality, and of being corrupt. The Ku Klux Klan increased their activities, and the Congressional Investigating Committee reported 260 outrages, including 7 murders and the whipping of 72 whites and 141 Negroes. Holden says, "These combinations were at first purely political in their character, and many good citizens were induced to join them, But gradually, under the leadership of ambitious and disconnected politicians, and under the pretext that society needed to be regulated by some authority outside or above the law, their character was changed, and those secret clans began to commit murder, to rob, whip, scourge, and mutilate unoffending citizens. They met in secret, in disguise, and arms, in a dress of a certain kind intended to conceal their persons and their horses, and to terrify those whom they menaced or assaulted. They held their camps, and under leaders they decreed judgment against their peaceable fellow citizens, from mere intimidations to scourgings, mutilations, the burning of churches, schoolhouses, mills, and in many cases to murder. This organization, under different names, but cemented by a common purpose, is believed to have embraced not less than 40,000 voters in North Carolina. Governor Holden said in his proclamation of July 19, 1870, "For months past, there has been maturing in these localities, under the guidance of bad and disloyal men, a dangerous secret insurrection. I have invoked public opinion to aid me in suppressing this treason. I have issued proclamation after proclamation to the people of the state to break up these unlawful combinations. I have brought to bear every civil power to restore peace and order, but all in vain. The Constitution and the laws of the United States and of this state are set at naught. The civil courts are no longer a protection to life, liberty, and property. Assassination and outrage go unpunished, and the civil magistrates are intimidated and are afraid to perform their functions. To the majority of the people of these sections, the approach of night is like the entrance into the valley of the shadow of death. The men dare not sleep beneath their roofs at night, but abandoning their wives and little ones, wander in the woods until day. The legislature met in 1870 with 3 Negro senators and 19 Negro members of the House. This small proportion of Negroes was continued up until 1876, the number of senators remaining about the same, but the number of representatives being reduced to 7. The appropriations for schools and relief were not sufficient, and there was continued complaint. A system of public schools had been inaugurated in April 1869. The impeachment of Holden was repeatedly demanded. 17 colored members of the legislature issued an address in 1870 in which they defended Holden. The only offense of Governor Holden, and that which has brought down the wrath of the dominant party upon him, is that he thwarted the designs of a band of assassins who had prepared to sacrifice this state in the blood of the poor people on the night before the last election on account of their political sentiments and to prevent them from voting. Because he dispersed this murderous host organized by the so-called Conservative Party, they proposed to destroy him. First proposed to suspend him, then to go through a mock trial before the Senate, as they have already done before the House, where a true bill has been found without taking testimony. After impeachments, his enemies will not be satisfied until he is hanged, unless happily their own gallows should overtake them. When Governor Holden is disposed of, those whom he protected will be the next victims. For the blood of one man will not satisfy their thirst. They are mad because Reconstruction measures have triumphed, and we are permitted to represent you in this body. They are mad because we refuse to bow the knee to them." The legislature, which convened in the Capitol in the fall of 1870, was made up of a Senate of 36 conservatives, 3 Negroes, and 2 carpetbaggers, and a House of 75 conservatives, 19 Negroes, and 2 carpetbaggers. One of the first things which this new legislature did was to take steps leading to the impeachment of the governor. He was accused of being the head of the Union League in North Carolina, of believing in the social and the political equality of the two races, and of conducting the affairs of the state of North Carolina in a wasteful way. As members of the Union League, it was to be expected that Negroes would give their full support to the only political organization which made any pretense at wanting them among its membership, and which they believed to be the one thing standing between them and re-enslavement. In a letter to Captain Pride Jones of Hillsborough, Holden said, "Every citizen, no matter of what color, or how poor or humble, has a right to labor for a living without being molested, to express his political opinions without let or hindrance, and to be absolutely at peace in his own house." But the strategy of North Carolina became increasingly clear: to drive out Northerners who dared to take political leadership of Negroes, and to unite all whites against Negroes on a basis of race prejudice and mob law. Thus, under race, they camouflaged a dictatorship of land and capital over black labor and indirectly over white labor. The Albemarle Register said, "This paper in the future is in favor of drawing the line between whites and blacks, regardless of consequences." Despite all the charges of fraud, corruption, and stealing, Holden, when finally impeached, was charged not with dishonesty, but with using and paying troops to put down insurrection in the state. He said, in defense, that as regarded the white militia, "We all agreed, at least those of us who took part in this discussion, that the governor would be employing a militia composed of Ku Klux to put down Ku Klux. That as regards the colored militia, it was inexpedient and impolitic to use them, owing to the prejudice in regard to race and color. It was then suggested, by whom I do not recollect, that it would be best to organize a regular force." White Northerners added that far from the Ku Klux trying to stamp out corruption, that to punish or prevent corruption is no part of the object of the Ku Klux, but that they tolerate those who rob the state. This may be because among the robbers are members of both political parties, including some who direct and others who control and might easily suppress the Klan, and if the Ku Klux were to punish corruption impartially, they would strike men in sympathy with themselves, even their own members. Another reason for the indulgence of public robbers by Ku Klux is that the doings of both tend to the same result, the overthrow of the state government. The one assaults, while the other undermines. In the ensuing Constitutional Convention, Tourjay, one of the ablest and most honest of the carpetbaggers, defended the carpetbaggers and said that Columbus, the Pilgrims, and even Jesus Christ were carpetbaggers. O'Hara, a Negro delegate, moved to make the cohabitation of a white person and a Negro a felony. This was rejected 59-46. Tourjay proposed to make it a misdemeanor. This was rejected 61-43. From 1870 on, North Carolina was in the power of the Democratic Party, so that radical Reconstruction controlled the state for only 2 years. Wages were low during Reconstruction, and probably would have been under any government. In 1860, $110 a year was the wages of a man hired out. In 1867, $104. In 1868 and 1870, $89. The value of the chief crops was $38 million in 1867, $31 million in 1870. In 1860, the value of manufactured products was $9,011,050. In 1870, $19,021,327. Concerning this whole North Carolina struggle, Tourjay expressed the truth that he said that democratic methods of government were never indigenous to Southern soil. In truth, it has never become acclimated there, but has remained from the first an exotic. A few thousand of the white people of North Carolina accepted it in 1868 simply as the equivalent of the unionism which has always held so dear a place in their hearts. A few hundred Adullamites accepted it as the alternative of political bankruptcy and the shibboleth of profitable power, and a few score of earnest natives accepted it with a clear perception of its basic principles and a bona fide belief in their beneficence and righteousness. A few hundred carpetbaggers received it as the spontaneous product of their native states, the sentiments for which they fought and bled. The African race, in bulk, received it as the incarnation and sheet anchor of that liberty which they had just tested. Ignorance, poverty, and inexperience were its chief characteristics. At the beginning of the 19th century, Virginia had something over 300,000 Negroes, of whom 285,369 were slaves and 20,124 free Negroes. By 1860, the slaves had increased to 490,865 and the free Negroes to 58,042. The western counties of Virginia, beyond the mountains, opposed secession, and at a meeting held in August 1861, they called themselves the Restored Government of Virginia and made F. H. Pierpont governor. This body gave the consent of Virginia to the forming of a new state of West Virginia. Governor Pierpont then moved his capital to Alexandria under the protection of the federal armies, but actually had only a small part of Virginia under his control. In May 1864, this restored government adopted a constitution with white suffrage. President Lincoln recognized the government, and President Johnson, May 9, 1865, restored federal functions in Virginia. A session of the legislature met in June 1865, passed some black laws, and congratulated itself on escaping Negro suffrage. The government was moved from Alexandria to Richmond, and immediately there appeared a split between the former Confederates and the Unionists. The freedmen were especially disappointed and held a convention in Alexandria in August 1865. The body reviewed the indignities, brutalities, and inhumanities to which the Negroes were subjected as slaves. It asserted that a large number of Virginians bore the Negroes an undeserved malice because they were black and had been freed by the United States government. As a protection against such people, the freedmen demanded the rights, privileges, and immunities common to citizens, including the right to vote. The freedmen declared that they were prepared to exercise the suffrage intelligently, and they pledged their loyalty to the interests of the state and to the United States. They presented a claim to citizenship on the ground that they should not be regarded as a separate class, but granted the considerations prayed as an evidence of the natural equality of all men. In the congressional election of October 12th, the reactionaries were completely successful and in January 1866 passed a stern black code with the usual vagrancy law and contract labor law. Ordinary civil rights were granted the Negro, but he could testify in court only when he was himself involved. Even some of the Confederates thought these laws too drastic, and General Terry prohibited their application. The Congressional Committee of 15 began an inquiry into affairs in Virginia in January 1866 and had 49 witnesses of all shades of opinion. The reactionaries were bitter toward the Negroes, and there were several riotous outbreaks. The Unionists called a convention at Alexandria, May 17th, and took a stand in favor of public schools and Negro suffrage. Late in 1866, Pierpont, recognizing the trend of affairs, recommended modification of the vagrancy law and ratification of the 14th Amendment, but the legislature at first refused, and then in extra session debated the matter. Before they had come to any final decision, the Reconstruction laws became operative. The Reconstruction Act of March 2nd had been passed when the legislature met again. On March 5th, the Negroes had attempted to vote in a municipal election at Alexandria. The mayor and judge asked advice of President Johnson and of the Attorney General, but received no answer. The Negroes cast 1,400 votes, the white conservatives 1,000 votes, and the white radicals 72 votes. The Negro votes were not counted, and the military commander forbade further local elections until after registration. Meantime, the considerable immigration of white politicians and officeholders began to organize the Negro vote. Among those who early took leadership was James W. Honeycutt, a native of South Carolina who became the radical leader of the Negroes. John C. Underwood became a more moderate leader, and John Minor Botts, a conservative leader. At first, Botts was not in favor of Negro suffrage. Various Republican papers were established which told the Negroes that they were in danger of being re-enslaved, and they were given to understand that the plantations would be broken up and every freedman given a 40-acre farm. The reactionaries were strongly against Negro suffrage. They wanted the Negro neither to vote nor hold office, but would grant him some civil and economic rights. They nevertheless insisted that Negroes cooperate with their former masters. There was a great deal of sickness, poverty, and death among Negroes at this time, and some crime. There was also much philanthropic effort, fraternal and insurance societies, attempts at theatrical exhibitions, and some intermarriage between the races. Negro churches and schools were built and burned. A riot took place in Alexandria on Christmas Day, 1865, in which two whites were injured and 14 Negroes killed. Yet Whitelaw Reed said, "The Negroes were everywhere found quiet, respectful, and peaceable. They were the only class at work, and in perhaps most respects, their outward conduct was that of excellent citizens." With regard to their deportment, the Alexandria Gazette expressed the consensus of press opinion that the Negroes generally behaved themselves respectfully toward the whites.